Blog Talk Radio.
Listening to Ken Hudnall. This is the Ken Hudnall Show, coming to you from our studios in exciting El Paso, Texas, gateway to the Old West and the most haunted city in the country. Well, it's been an interesting day news-wise. It sounds like the whole world's just going crazy. We were talking about conspiracies yesterday. I got told about a new one today I'd never heard of before. The League of the South. Now, this group makes no bones about their intent. They declare that its ultimate goal is a free and independent Southern Republic. It's the intention of the League of the South to form active chapters in every county in every Southern state. Encourage individuals and families to secede from the corrupting influence of post-Christian American culture. Withdraw support of and allegiance to a regime that's imperiled the future. Withdraw from the public education system and establish our own private academies. Resurrect the Southern cultural base, whatever that might be. And seek only political leaders who are truly willing to serve others. Well, now, there's a couple of things that make sense. We have elected leaders who believe they are by birth entitled to lead. They forget about their constituents once they hit Washington. And they think they can do as they please, not as their constituents want them to do. By joining the League of the South, according to their website, people have placed themselves among a group of men and women who are not content to sit by and allow their land, liberty, and culture to be destroyed by an alien regime and ideology. Well, there's quite a number of groups out there that have unusual beliefs, I guess would be the correct way to say it. I'm not sure what to think about the League of the South. We got enough problems without it refighting the Civil War. One interesting email I got wanted me to discuss the assassination of John Lennon. Now, no sane, rational person can ever understand why somebody'd want to kill somebody. But if the assassination of John Lennon had occurred in 1966 after the press misquoted him as saying the Beatles were more popular than Jesus Christ, the crime would at least have some context. However, 14 years after that confusion and after 5 years spent with his wife Yoko Ono, an infant son in virtual solitude, you have to ask yourself, why was he assassinated at that point in time? He was gunned down in front of his apartment building in New York City on December 8, 1980. He lived at the Dakota. I saw it when I was living in New York. Big building. Ironically, he had autographed his new album, Double Fantasy, for his murderer, Mark David Chapman, when Lennon and his wife had first left the Dakota apartments that evening. Incredulously, the doorman of the Dakota, instead of grabbing Chapman, yelled at him and asked if he knew what he'd done. Chapman, who had holstered his revolver, had just shot Lennon 4 times in the back and stood there idly flipping through the pages of a paperback edition of Catcher in the Rye. Now, his response was a very calm one. He said, "Yeah, I just shot John Lennon." In August of 66, when the Beatles were in Chicago, an American Teen magazine picked up on the interview that Lennon had given to the London Evening Standard on March 4th, in which he remarked that with the skewed values of the 60s, the Beatles had more influence on the kids than anything else, including Jesus. Well, there was a firestorm of protests in the Bible Belt. Conservative and right-wing preachers in the Vatican even got into the act. Lennon apologized for misunderstanding, but it was apparent to the Beatles that the press were now prepared to pillory them for any word misspoken, and they soon stopped touring or talking to the media. In the late 60s was the beginning of the gotcha press. Now, in the late 60s, Lennon became an outspoken opponent of the Vietnam War. In protest of Britain's involvement in Nigeria and British support of the U.S. role in Vietnam, he returned the member of the Order of the British Empire had received from Queen Elizabeth II. Following their honeymoon after their marriage in 69, Lennon and Yoko Ono recorded Give Peace a Chance, which quickly became the peace movement's international anthem. You know, returning medals and things like that, it may be symbolic, but it doesn't accomplish anything. When John Kerry said he went up to the fence around the White House and threw his medals over the fence that he'd received for his service in Vietnam, all he did was show that he had turned his back on his fellow soldiers. It accomplished nothing. After the Lennons moved to New York City in the early 70s, Nixon and other right-wing politicians, such as Senator Strom Thurmond and Attorney General John Mitchell, viewed Lennon as the great devil of all subversive activity. He was a popular, outspoken individual who could start riots and rebellions. J. Edgar Hoover agreed with their fears, and Lennon's FBI file bore the large handwritten block-lettered motto, "All extremists should be considered dangerous." Government agents were assigned to get enough on the Lennon so they could be deported back to Britain. Well, by 1976, John and Yoko had finally resolved their argument with the U.S. immigration officials. Yoko had given birth to their first child, and John had decided to retire from the music business. But curious to see if he still had the ability to write songs that people like to hear, he picked up his guitar again in the 1980s. As he lay semi-conscious and bleeding in front of the Dakota, Mark David Chapman was very calm, almost serene in his demeanor. Later, he said he felt nothing at the time of the shooting, no emotion, no anger, nothing but silence in the brain. He did claim that before he pulled the trigger, there was a voice inside his head that screamed at him over and over, "Do it, do it, do it." Well, conspiracy theorists were quick to name Paul McCartney, Lennon's chief rival in the Beatles, as hiring an assassin to put an end to their competition. Some even named Yoko and blamed her for nursing jealousies for the times that Lennon had strayed from their marriage vows. The official verdict? Another lone nut gunman. Like Oswald. Like Sirhan Sirhan. Like James Earl Ray. This is the only country that never has a conspiracy. Just lone nut gunman. British lawyer, journalist Fenton Bressler thought that Chapman seemed just a little too much like Sirhan. His quiet, calm, unnatural tone and manner after the murder is saying a voice in his head kept telling him to do it. He theorized in Who Killed John Lennon that Chapman was probably a programmed, brainwashed assassin. Now, picking up on Bressler's theory, we're reminded in the years of social upheaval in the 60s, operatives in the CIA super-secret MKUltra project were experimenting with LSD, hypnosis, and a host of other mind-control techniques, some of which had been tested by Nazi doctors on unwilling concentration camp prisoners. And a lot of those Nazi doctors were here, continuing their experiments in the employment of the U.S. government. Bressler then learned that Chapman had even been signing his name John Lennon prior to the assassination. He once told an interviewer he'd killed Lennon in order to promote J.D. Salinger's novel Catcher in the Rye. Bressler thinks the novel might have been the mental mechanism that triggered Chapman's programming. Now, when he was younger, Chapman hadn't been a weird loner. Friends knew him as a socially minded, likable individual. His family pointed out he'd been a sensitive young man who was a counselor and good with kids. An odd factor in his biography is the period when he signed up for the YMCA overseas program and in June of 75 ended up in Beirut. Although he was a born-again Christian, he began taking drugs in college, had a nervous breakdown, and became a hospitalized mental patient. When he was released, he became so obsessed with John Lennon, he married a Japanese woman because of her resemblance to Yoko Ono. Chapman's attorney was absolutely dumbfounded when, after he had spent 6 months diligently preparing to defend his client on an insanity plea, Chapman suddenly changed his plea to guilty. He said a voice inside his cell had spoken to him, told him to admit to the murder. Well, as I've said earlier, guilty pleas and cut off any possibility of a investigation. So if, in fact, he was a programmed assassin, by pleading guilty, the idea that anybody would discover it became a non-issue. And as you'll see in my new series, The Assassination Files, there may be something to what he said. Well, there was another secret group that's centuries old. Came out of West Africa. It sacrificed its victims, drank their blood, and ate their flesh in a belief that these acts would grant them supernatural powers. In the spiritual belief of many African tribes, a leopard's a powerful totem animal. It guides the spirits of the dead to rest. And for many centuries in West Africa, there has existed the leopard cult, whose members kill as does the leopard by slashing and gashing and mauling their human prey with steel claws and knives. There was even an outbreak of that in New York City number of years ago. Once a victim has been chosen, the date and time of the killing agreed on, the executioner, known as the Batiyeli, is selected. The Batiyeli wears the ritual leopard mask and a leopard skin robe. Preferably, the human sacrifice is performed at one of the leopard cult's jungle shrines. After the cults kill their victim, they drink the blood and eat the flesh. The cultists believe that a magical elixir known as Borfima, which they brew from their victim's intestines, grants them superhuman powers and enables them to actually transform into leopards. The first serious outbreak of leopard cult murders occurred shortly after World War I in Sierra Leone and Nigeria. The region's white administrators captured and executed a number of the cult's members and felt the nasty business had been suppressed. In actual fact, the group just went underground, continuing to perform ritual murders sporadically every year over the next 20 years. 1946, there were 48 cases of murder and attempted murder committed by the leopard cult. Very much like the Mau Mau in Kenya, the leopard men had begun directing many of their attacks against whites, seemingly as a demonstration to the native population that the cult had no fear of the police or of the white rulers. The trend continued during the first 7 months of 1947, when there were 43 known ritual killings performed. Early in 1947, Terry Wilson, who'd been the district officer of a province in eastern Nigeria for only 6 months, discovered that the leopard men had begun operating in his jurisdiction, killing mainly young women, which was a slight change to how they operated. When Wilson raided the house of a local chief named Ngogo, his men found a leopard mask, a leopard skin robe, and a steel claw. And when acting on a tip from an informer, Wilson ordered his police officers to dig in near the chief's house. They found the remains of 13 victims. Chief was put in prisoner right trial, and Wilson set out to put an end to the leopard's men reign of terror. Although he received 200 additional police officers as reinforcements, the leopard men became increasingly bold in their nocturnal attacks. One night, they defied the police by sacrificing a female victim inside the police compound and got away without being seen. You know, at that point, the inhabitants of the region lost all confidence in the police and their ability to stop the powerful leopard men. Even some of Wilson's men began to believe that the cultists might truly have the ability to shapeshift into leopards and fade unseen into the darkness. Well, by mid-August of 47, Wilson knew his men were becoming unnerved, so he decided to attempt to set a trap for the leopard men. On the path to a village where several slayings had taken place, Wilson sent one of his best men, posing as the son of a native woman. The two walked side by side toward the village while Wilson and a dozen other officers concealed themselves in the bushes at the side of the path. Suddenly, a tall man in leopard robes charged the couple, swinging a large club. The young police officer struggled with the leopard man, but before Wilson and the other men could arrive on the scene, the cultist had smashed the officer's skull with the club and fled into the bushes. On a hunch, Wilson told his men to leave the officer's body in the bushes beside the path. Dismissing his other men, he hid himself in the brush. About midnight, just as Wilson was about to return to the compound, a nightmarish figure crawling on all fours emerged from the jungle, pounced on the young officer's corpse, and began clawing at his face like a leopard. Other than claws raking the body, Wilson caught the glint of a two-pronged steel claw in the moonlight. The killer had returned to complete the cult ritual of sacrifice. Wilson advanced on the leopard man, and when he spotted him, the robed murderer snarled as if he was truly a big cat. Well, when he jumped to his feet and drew back to hit Wilson with the two-pronged claw, Wilson shot him in the chest. Well, displaying the body of the murderer, Wilson proved that to the people of the district that the leopard men were not supernatural beings. The members of the cult didn't have magic powers that could make them impervious to bullets. They were, after all, men of flesh and blood, savage, bestial, and vicious, but men nonetheless. Once word had spread that the district officer had killed one of the leopard men, witnesses began to come forward in great numbers with clues to the identity of the other cult members and the possible location of a secret jungle shrine. Can't talk. During February 48, 73 initiated members of the cult were arrested and sent to prison. Eventually, 39 of them were sentenced to death and hung in a Bok prison. Their executions witnessed by a number of local tribal chiefs who could testify to their villages the leopard men were not immortal. Now, Well, there is a lot of strange beliefs out there. There's a new cult that I heard about the last few days. This cult believes that Jesus has come back. He's living in China as a woman, and that Judgment Day is fast approaching. This new apocalyptic cult is called Lightning from the East. It emerged in China in 1990 with the claim that Jesus has returned as a 30-year-old woman who presently remains in hiding and has never been photographed. His female Jesus, whose surname is Ding, supposedly prophesied in Matthew chapter 24, verse 27. For as lightning comes out of the east and shines even unto the west, so shall the coming of the Son of Man be. Ding claims to be that lightning, and she warns of a fast approaching day of judgment. She explains she's been born again in China because it's the great red dragon referred to in the book of Revelation. In addition to gifts of great teaching, the female Messiah has written the third testament to the Bible and composed hymns, enough hymns to fill 10 CDs. Lightning from the East perhaps should be called a sect of Christianity since the group employs the language of that religion. It's upset China's 80 million Orthodox Christians by claiming to have a female Jesus who writes new doomsday scriptures and whose followers abduct other Christians and hold them for brainwashing sessions lasting as long as 5 days. Even Catholic nuns and priests have been held captive for days and forced to listen to impassioned lightning teachers tell them that Jesus of the Bible is the old one and the new Jesus has come and she'll destroy the earth. Lightning members who call themselves the congregation sing hymns that the new Savior has written to the tunes of familiar folk or Communist Party songs. If an abducted potential convert should ask why the all-powerful son or daughter of God should have to stay in hiding, the answer will be that she feels the need for secrecy at the present time. And she has a careful plan that's been worked out that she's following. Well, Lightning from the East boasts they've converted millions of Chinese to their style of Christian teaching. More conservative estimates say it's only about 300,000, but that's still a good many. Lightning converts argue they have an advantage over conventional Christians because they have a Jesus here and now who promises to take her followers with her directly to heaven as the days of judgment move across China and soon the world. Orthodox Christian priests and pastors preach virtues and values and downplay dire warnings about a final judgment. Lightning offers a Jesus who has come first to China and promises immediate salvation. Similar, I guess, to the concept of commit all the crimes you want and go to confession and you're relieved of all guilt. Chinese officials stated their 2-year campaign against such evil cults as the Falun Gong has placed 2,000 members of Lightning in jail. However, the Communist Party's restrictions on religion don't permit enough ministers to graduate from the nation's 18 state-approved Protestant seminaries to provide for China's hundreds of thousands of believers. So many Christians unknowingly join Lightning, thinking they're joining a traditional or Orthodox Christian church. And Lightning from the East already has followers in North America. There's a booklet called The Voice of God in China that's being distributed in Chinatowns in New York and San Francisco. Ding, the female Messiah, speaks as God in the first person. Let everyone use the lightest strength that my name be further glorified. I came to earth long ago, bringing the glory of Israel to the east. In these last days, my name shall change again, not Jehovah, nor Jesus, nor the Messiah. I shall be called the Almighty, Omnipotent God, and I shall use this name to end all ages. Well, the theory or the story is that this new Jesus may soon be coming to America. I guess in this day of Me Too, that the idea of a female Jesus is not too far-fetched. Well, there is a lot of talk that to get us into the various wars we've been in, our government has not minded the death of Americans. We've talked about FDR perhaps having orchestrated Pearl Harbor. A number of historians still insist that the nearly 1,200 lost aboard the RMS Lusitania were sacrificed in an effort to embroil the U.S. in World War I. Now, the Lusitania was an ocean liner of the British Cunard steamship line that was torpedoed by a German U-boat May 7, 1915, within sight of the southern coast of Ireland. The sinking of a passenger ship and the loss of almost 1,200 lives was instrumental in causing the U.S. to enter World War I and to declare war on Germany and its allies. And for over 90 years, there's been argument over whether or not Winston Churchill's Lord of the British Admiralty manipulated events to arrange for the liner's sinking in order to create an incident that would convince the U.S. to participate in the conflict against Germany. Remember, the U.S. at that time was viewed as isolationist. We didn't want to get involved in European wars. They were basically family squabbles anyway. The Lusitania and its sister ship, the Mauritania, were considerably smaller and less luxurious than the Olympic and Britannic of the rival White Star Line, but they were much faster and enabled Cunard to provide a weekly transatlantic departure schedule with just two vessels. When the Lusitania sank, she was on her 202nd crossing of the Atlantic. Short after World War I began, the British established a blockade of Germany that was eventually responsible for the death by starvation, malnutrition, and disease of 750,000 Germans. Germany's only hope of destroying the blockade was to sink as many warships as possible, and the U-boats were very effective in striving to attain that goal. The Lusitania, a luxury passenger liner and cargo ship, was immune from attack, as were all passenger ships, and unless it was suspected of violating the agreement that such vessels wouldn't transport ammunition and explosives to Great Britain. German intelligence had suspected the fast-moving ships of the Cunard Line of carrying contraband munitions, and the German embassy in the U.S. issued a public warning to travelers intending to embark for Great Britain that a state of war existed between Germany and its allies, and Great Britain and its allies, and the zone of war included the waters adjacent to the British Isles. Vessels flying the British flag were liable to destruction in those waters. And passengers who chose to travel on the ships of Great Britain or its allies must do so at their own risk. It was later learned that some of the wealthiest and most influential passengers had been warned a U-boat attack was likely against the Lusitania. Captain Walter Swiger, commander of the submarine U-20, released one torpedo at a distance of 700 yards and saw it hit the Lusitania and trigger a second violent explosion. On seeing that second explosion, Swiger felt justified in torpedoing the passenger vessel. It was obviously carrying munitions under assumed cargo designations. The Lusitania rolled over and sank in 18 minutes. Rescuers from Queenstown, Ireland managed to save 734 people from the seawater. Well, the Germans had guessed correctly, it turned out, because the Lusitania, under the description of bales of fur and boxes of cheese, carried in its hold millions of rounds of rifle ammunition, 1,250 cases of shrapnel shells, and 46 tons of aluminum powder for the Woolwich Arsenal. The British and American governments accused the U-boat of having launched a second torpedo at the sinking passenger ship, but the Germans denied doing so, claiming it was the munitions on board that caused that second explosion. Well, Churchill had engineered the destruction of one of Britain's finest ships and of 1,195 people, among them 128 Americans, in a sacrificial act intended to bring the U.S. into the war. He did succeed. The U.S. saw the sinking of the Lusitania as another barbaric attack by the Huns, as they were called at that time. Conspiracy theorists countered that the British Admiralty under Churchill's direction was well aware that the German U-boat command had issued a warning to all passenger ships that they would travel at their own risk. The Admiralty was also informed that the U-boat responsible for sinking two ships in recent days was still lurking in the waters off the southern coast of Ireland, the very path the Lusitania was scheduled to travel. Well, in spite of this knowledge, the Admiralty issued no special warning to the Lusitania, offered no escort to port, and didn't send any destroyers to search for the German submarine. It does seem apparent to some researchers there was a conspiracy to place the Lusitania in jeopardy in order to incite the Americans to enter the war. However, U.S. isolationist policies continued to maintain their hold on Congress until February 1917 when German Admiral Alfred von Tirpitz announced that U-boats would begin attacking all shipping in the North Atlantic, regardless of national or political allegiance. February 3rd, the U.S. broke off diplomatic relations with Germany. On that same day, a U-boat sank the U.S. liner Housatonic off the coast of Sicily. On March 18th, German submarines sank three U.S. registered vessels, the City of Memphis, the Vigilante, and the Illinois, without giving any type of warning. Then on April 2nd, Woodrow Wilson argued that the world must be safe for democracy, and on April 6th, Congress approved a declaration of war against Germany, leading to the so-called war to end all wars. Well, I was recently made aware. I've written several things on voodoo and spiritualism. Well, I was made aware of something called Macumba, also known as Spiritism, Candomblé, Ubanda. It resembles, in its outward appearances and some of its practices, voodoo. Trance states among the practitioners are induced by dancing and drumming. The ceremony climaxes with animal sacrifice. The ancient role of the shaman remains central to Macumba. The shaman is often a male, but sometimes they're females. Enters into a trance state and talks to the spirits in order to gain advice or aid for the supplicants. If anyone can participate in the Macumba ceremony, he or she must undergo an initiation. The aspirants must enter a trance during the dancing and the drumming and allow a god to possess them. Once the possession has taken place, the shaman must determine which gods are in which initiate so that the correct rituals can be performed. The process is enhanced by the sacrifice of an animal and the smearing of its blood over the initiates. Now, once the initiates have been bloodied, they take an oath of loyalty to the cult. Later, in the trance state and the possessing spirit have left, the aspirants, now members of the Macumba cult, usually have no memory of the ritual proceedings. Macumba was said to be born in the 1550s from a blending between the spirit worship of the African slaves brought to Brazil and the Roman Catholicism of the slaveholders. Although the captive slaves were forced to give token of obedience to an array of Christian saints and the god of their masters, the native priests soon realized how complementary the two faiths could be, especially since, unlike the slave owners in the U.S., the Brazilians allowed the slaves to keep their drums, and the drums were an important part of the Macumba ceremony. The Africans summoned their gods, the Orishas, with the sound of their drums and the rhythm of their dancing. The African god Exu became St. Anthony. Lamanja became Our Lady of the Glory. Oba became St. Joan of Arc. Oxala became Jesus Christ. Oxum became Our Lady of the Conception, and so on and so forth. From the melding of the two religious faiths, the Africans created the Samba, the rhythm of the saints, that has survived as an international dance. It does raise interesting questions and connections that come to light when you research some of the habits that we demonstrate in our festivals. Well, for over 100 years, the outrage cry of Remember the Maine is echoed in the halls of U.S. history. Even today, people can't agree who or what sank the great battleship. When the USS Maine blew up in Havana Harbor on the evening of February 15, 1898, most of the battleship's crew were sleeping or relaxing in the enlisted man's quarters in the forward part of the ship. Later investigations disclosed that 5 tons of powder charges for the battleship's 6- and 10-inch guns exploded, which basically obliterated the forward third of the ship and sent the remaining wreckage to the bottom of the harbor. 266 men died in the blast or within minutes of it. Another 6 died later from their injuries pulled from the water. Captain Charles Sigsbee and most of the officers of the vessel survived the disaster because their quarters were in the rear portion of the battleship. Now, the United States had been in sympathetic support of the Cubans in their struggle for freedom from Spain ever since the first insurrection between 1868 and 1878. On October 31st, 1873, the Spanish captured the ship Virginius, bringing aid and guns to the embattled Cuban revolutionaries and executed most of the crew, which included a number of American citizens. A declaration of war with Spain had been swaying on the brink ever since the Virginius incident, and popular sentiment in the U.S. to go to war was already fueled by the yellow press, as it was called, with accounts of horrible atrocities against the Cubans by the Spanish. When the Second Rebellion began in April 1895, Spain sent General Valeriano Weyler y Nicola, soon to be known as the Butcher, to quell the disturbances, and the stories about death and starvation of Cubans soon filled American newspapers. Pressure was placed on both President Grover Cleveland and William McKinley to declare war on Spain, but both men preferred to employ diplomacy. In 1897, Spain promised limited autonomy for Cuba, but the U.S. government was well aware that the revolutionaries would settle for nothing less than total independence. After riots broke out in Cuba in January of 1898, President McKinley sent the Maine to be at hand if the Americans on the island needed protecting. Battleship arrived in Havana on January 25, 1898, after an anxious Spain was notified of U.S. intentions. Although suspicious of U.S. true motives, the Spanish authorities allowed the ship to enter the harbor. Captain Sigsbee attuned to any potential misstep on a sensitive mission, didn't allow any of his enlisted men to go ashore. Then on February 15th, that mighty battleship was destroyed in one horrendous explosion. Spanish officials and the crews of the civilian steamer City of Washington were quickly at hand to rescue the survivors and look after the wounded. The Spanish authorities laid Sigsbee's initial suspicions of a hostile action against the Maine, and his first telegram to the U.S. Navy Department urged suspension of public opinion until a suitable inquiry had been made. Well, the U.S. Navy's 4-week inquiry held in Havana concluded from the condition of the submerged wreckage that a mine had been detonated underneath the Maine. Now, the board didn't make accusations as to who might have placed the mine, but the American public had already judged the Spanish as guilty for killing 266 Americans, and they reacted with outrage. Remember the Maine became the slogan of the day. President McKinley continued his efforts for a diplomatic settlement between Spain and Cuba, was finally pressured into organizing a blockade of Cuba on April 21st. With diplomacy at an impasse, Spain declared war on the United States April 23rd. Congress was ready with its declaration of war on April 25th and made it retroactive to April 21st. Spanish-American War lasted only 5 months, but it signaled the emergence of the U.S. as a world power. Now, over 100 years, conspiracy theorists have argued that warmongers in the U.S. sabotaged the Maine to force the nation to declare war on Spain. Possibility that somebody on board the battleship might have ignited 5 tons of powder charges and killed 266 of his fellow crewmen was investigated by a Navy Department inquiry in 1911. Now, there were solid arguments presented that a mine external to the Maine caused the blast. was also evidence that spontaneous combustion of coal in the bunker next to the powder magazine caused the explosion. In 1976, Admiral Hyman Rickover of the U.S. Navy published the results of an investigation that concluded that the explosion was a result of a coal bunker fire. Well, there's a number of historians who doubted this theory, still maintaining the blast was caused by sabotage. In 1998, the National Geographic Society explored the wreck and decided that based on a structural analysis, the tragedy could have been caused by the ignition of volatile coal dust in a bunker. Well, at this late date, we'll probably never know the truth of what really happened that February night in Havana Harbor. But one thing we can be sure of, this conspiracy is going to, and controversy is going to linger on. Well, turning to the world of the UFO, there was a lot of controversy there. A lot of folks have set themselves up as the end-all, be-all of UFO research. A lot of new UFO shows are hitting the media. But one of the biggest controversies began in 1987. When three UFO investigators announced that they had proof of a secret group within the government that had conspired to keep the truth about extraterrestrial contact from the public. The documentary filmmaker Jamie Shandera claimed that in December of 1984 he had received two rolls of undeveloped 35mm film in the mail. Once he developed the film, he discovered what appeared to be a briefing report to President-elect Dwight D. Eisenhower from a group of 12 prestigious and top-secret investigators who worked under the code name of Operation Majestic 12. The document contained details of the recovery, analysis, and official cover-up of the 1947 crash outside of Roswell. Within the report was a description of the four human-like beings found near the wreckage of what had been determined to be a crashed extraterrestrial spacecraft. The secret analysis of the beings acknowledged their human-like appearance, but it concluded that the biological and evolutionary processes responsible for their development had apparently been quite different from that observed or postulated in Homo sapiens. According to these documents, all four of the entities were dead, and their corpses had been mutilated by desert scavengers and been badly decomposed due to exposure to the elements. From what Shandera could ascertain, some unknown source had leaked the documents to him just a few weeks after the death of the last member of the Majestic 12 group. To help him develop a more complete analysis of the papers, Shandera enlisted the assistance of prominent UFO researchers William Moore and Stanton Friedman. June 14, 1987, at the 24th Annual National UFO Conference in Burbank, Shandera, Friedman, and Moore made public their investigations into what they purported to be documented proof of a government cover-up of UFOs that began in 1947. According to the documents leaked to Shandera, the Majestic 12 group consisted of the following individuals: Lloyd V. Berkner, known for scientific achievements in the field of physics and electronics, Special Assistant to the Secretary of State in charge of the Military Assistance Program, an Executive Secretary of what's now known as the Research and Development Board of the National Military Establishment. Detlev Bronk, physiologist and biophysicist of international repute, Chairman of the National Research Council and member of the Medical Advisory Board of the Atomic Energy Commission. Vannevar Bush, a brilliant scientist who served from 1947 to 1948 as chairman of the research and development for the National Military Establishment. Gordon Gray, Assistant Secretary of the Army in 1947, Secretary of the Army in 1949. Dr. Jerome Hunsaker, an aeronautical scientist and design engineer, chairman of the National Advisory Committee for Aeronautics. Major General Robert Montague, Sandia Base Commander, Albuquerque, New Mexico, from July 47 to February 51, General Nathan Twining, commander of the 20th Air Force, whose B-29s dropped the atomic bomb on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. In December 45, he was named commanding general of the Air Material Command at Wright Field. In 1950, he became acting deputy chief of staff for personnel at the Air Force headquarters in Washington, D.C. Dr. Donald Menzel, director of the Harvard Observatory, long acknowledged as a leading authority on the solar chromosphere and co-formulator of the calculations that led to initial radio contact with the moon in 1946. James B. Forrestal, Undersecretary, then Secretary of the Navy, 1947 became Secretary of Defense, coordinating the activities of all U.S. Armed Forces. Forrestal, for public consumption, was said to have committed suicide while at Bethesda Naval Hospital for psychiatric observation. In actuality, there are many stories that he would run down the halls of the Pentagon screaming that we're being invaded. And it was believed that he was murdered to shut him up. Rear Admiral Sidney Sowers, Deputy Chief of Naval Intelligence, before organizing the Central Intelligence Office in January of 46. Now, one thing that calls into question Sowers' involvement is he failed as head of the newly created Central Intelligence Officer, had to be replaced. His main claim to fame, other than having been an admiral during World War II, was he ran the Kroger stores, I believe, in Memphis. Hoyt Vandenberg, commanding general of the 9th Air Force before being named Assistant Chief of Intelligence in 46, appointed Director of Central Intelligence in June of 46. His uncle was a big shot in Congress. Rear Admiral Roscoe H. Hillenkoetter, the first director, May of 47 to September of 1950, of the CIA, the Permanent Intelligence Agency, evolved from the office organized by Sowers. There was the OSS, disbanded by Truman at the insistence of Hoover. And then, having realized he made a mistake, the Central Intelligence Group was created, as headed by Sowers, and that morphed into the Central Intelligence Agency. Well, upon seeing the list of MJ-12's alleged personnel, UFO researchers agreed if a UFO had crashed and been recovered in Roswell in 47, this was the kind of panel that would have accomplished a thorough investigation of the craft. All these individuals had been at the top of their respective areas of experiences and expertise during the 40s and had added benefit to high-level government experience. The more skeptical investigators agreed that Document A, that purported to be a letter dated September 24, 1947, from President Truman and Secretary of Defense Forrestal, appeared to be genuine. But they pointed out that even though Truman did refer to Operation Majestic 12 in the letter, there was nothing linking the group to UFO investigations. Others questioned why Hillenkoetter, head of the CIA, listed as the briefing officer on the MJ-12 document, would remain quiet about the crash flying saucer and the alien bodies when he became active in the civilian UFO research in 1957. Well, most military men who are at the level of having secret clearances don't discuss what they have been involved in while on active duty. The biggest shocker to longtime UFO researchers was the discovery of the name of Donald Menzel, the Harvard astronomer, well known as a passionate debunker of flying saucers and the author of three anti-UFO books. Well, the Robertson panel is one reason for that. They said that was too volatile for the public to know. Well, Stanton Friedman, until his death, continued to investigate the MJ-12 enigma and strongly defends his original research and conclusions. Other investigators claim to have found supportive evidence in a secret memo from President Roosevelt, written as early as February 44, which he calls for a special committee on non-terrestrial science and technology and urges that group to face the reality that Earth is not the only planet harboring intelligent life in the universe. Some UFO researchers suggest there was a crash of an extraterrestrial spaceship near Cape Girardeau, Missouri in 41, that prompted astonished scientists to evaluate the potential in discovering such advanced technology. And I'll point out in my book, Beyond Roswell, which is becoming a TV series on the History Channel, I discuss that crash. In fact, I discuss a number of crashes the government really doesn't want to talk about. In spite of defenders of the UFO research field, the authenticity of the MJ-12 documents still remains suspect. Skeptical researchers have labeled them as clearly false and fraudulent, pointing out that a thorough search to the records of the Truman administration reveals no executive order. Was that a UFO investigative group? And researchers who've served in the military have stated that the clearest indication of a hoax lies in the many incorrect military terms used in these official documents, suggesting the creators of the documents had never served in the armed forces. And certainly that could be a issue. Then again, maybe not. Well, the there are a number of assassinations that has plagued this country. One of which was Malcolm X. Now, no one will ever know if Malcolm X suspected that something was wrong that Sunday afternoon. It was February 21st, 1965, when he arrived with his family at the Audubon Ballroom in Harlem to speak at an Organization of Afro-American Unity rally. Only a week had passed since the militant black leader's home had been firebombed, and he must have noticed there were no police inside the ballroom and only two stationed outside. Now, if you look at the assassination of Martin Luther King and of Malcolm X, and even of the Kennedys, you will see that security was not what it should have been, which is a red flag to begin with. For Malcolm X, an assassination attempt was always a possibility, but he never turned down police protection. There were 400 men and women crowded into that ballroom, but none of the dark-suited Nation of Islam guards standing near the stage and at the back of the room had bothered to search anybody for weapons. Later, Malcolm's pregnant wife, Betty Shabazz, when Malcolm X returned from Africa in June of 64, became an Orthodox Muslim and took the name Ihaj Malik El Shabazz. Well, she'd be told that there were dozens of police officers across the street waiting in a hospital position where they're allegedly at the request of Malcolm, who told them that their presence in the ballroom would create tension among the members of the audience. Well, she insisted her husband never made such a request. Malcolm X waited with Betty and their four children in the anteroom until the rally began. Then he asked two of his bodyguards to escort them out to the ballroom and seat them in the box near the front of the stage. The bodyguards known that the normally complacent Malcolm seemed nervous and irritable. Benjamin Goodman finished making the opening speech and introduced Malcolm. The civil rights leader, founder of the OAAU, got to his feet, managed a slight smile, and walked out to the stage to loud applause. He went to the podium and began to speak when a fight broke out near the rear of the ballroom. Malcolm asked the two men to cool it. Just as a loud explosion sounded in the back of the room and heavy smoke began to fill the area. As bodyguards ran to the back to investigate the disturbances, a man stood up from the front row and fired both barrels of a sawed-off shotgun at Malcolm. As the civil rights leader fell backward, grabbing at his chest, two more men rushed the stage, firing pistols at him. The FBI report, dated February 22, 1965, stated that Malcolm X had 10 bullet wounds in his chest, thigh, and ankle, and 4 bullet creases in the chest and thigh. The bullets were identified as a 9mm, several shotgun pellets, and 145 slug. Both blasts from the sawed-off shotgun had penetrated Malcolm X's heart and aorta. Clearly, with a sawed-off shotgun involved, somebody wanted him down. Many of his followers rushed to Malcolm's body, but it was quickly determined he's dead. The majority of the crowd in the ballroom were pushing to get out, uncertain that there was going to be a fire sweeping through the place. Others went after the shooters. One assassin managed to escape by crawling out a window in the restroom. Two others were beaten and kicked by the angry crowd as they tried to run down the stairs to the street. 22-year-old Talmadge Hayer, also known as Thomas Hagen, was shot in the leg by one of Malcolm's bodyguards and kicked and beaten by the crowd until rescued by two uniformed policemen. The other assassin caught by the crowd somehow managed to escape even after being knocked down by an undercover policeman named Gene Roberts, member of the Bureau of Special Services. Roberts then ran to the stage and attempted to resuscitate Malcolm. Bodyguard stepped aside, recognizing Roberts as Brother Gene, as they called him, a police officer who had grown very close to Malcolm. Now begins the mystery. Who ordered the assassination? The Nation of Islam became first to the minds of many of Malcolm's followers. In addition to the Organization of Afro-American Unity, Malcolm had founded the Muslim Mosque Incorporated, and many believed that the Nation of Islam's leaders were jealous of his ability to recruit their members into the Muslim Mosque. Malcolm, who had once been extremely close to Elijah Muhammad, the head of the Nation of Islam, had later publicly denounced him as an adulterer. In turn, Muhammad had denounced Malcolm for deviating from the peaceful teachings of the Quran. Louis Farrakhan, a prominent Nation of Islam minister, told Muslims that those who followed Malcolm X would be led to hell or to their doom. However, after Malcolm's assassination, Farrakhan publicly apologized to Betty Shabazz. After researching more than 300,000 pages of declassified FBI and CIA documents, Carl Evans, author of The Judas Factor, believes the assassination was arranged by Malcolm's former friend, John Ali, an agent informer for an intelligence agency. Although Malcolm didn't believe Ali had been responsible for Malcolm's suspension from the Nation of Islam, Ali rose to the position of National Secretary of the Nation of Islam. Some investigators remember how angry organized crime bosses have been at Malcolm for his effective crusade against drugs, alcohol, and crime in Harlem. The militant black leader had been very successful in cleaning up the streets, replacing slums with black pride and black businesses. Perhaps the greatest number of conspiracy theorists to vote for the FBI's COINTELPRO program and recall FBI Director Hoover's mandate to get the goods on and or dispose of radical militant civil rights groups of war protesters by any means possible. COINTELPRO was a counterintelligence program. Agents were to neutralize subversive political organizations and dissidents through covert means. And if you needed to shoot somebody, well, just don't let it trace back to the FBI. The first edition of the New York Herald Tribune on February 22, 1965, was printed on Sunday evening, just a few hours after the assassination, for distribution Monday morning. The top headline in the first edition read, "Malcolm X slain by gunman is 400 in the ballroom watch." The Reed article, written by Jimmy Breslin, mentioned two suspects rescued by police: Talmadge Hayer taken to Bellevue Hospital to every police guard, and an unnamed person taken to Wadsworth Avenue precinct. Well, we've come to the end of another show. We'll finish this on Monday. Until then, Ken Hudnall Show, saying have a truly great evening.